Perspective. This program provides a forum for women to speak out on issues which concern them. And listeners will have an opportunity to participate in the program by calling the KANU open line at 864-4530. And now here's the moderator for A Feminist Perspective, KU Dean of Women, Emily Taylor.
Hello, this is Casey Ikey, a guest moderator in place of Emily Taylor, who is serving on the panel tonight. Thank you for tuning in to A Feminist Perspective. This weekly show is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, a program and information service of the Dean of Women's Office, located in 220 Strong Hall. Also located in this office is our Women's Library. This library contains vast amounts of information, news clippings, magazine articles, research studies, and books pertaining to the many aspects of the women's movement. We would like to invite you to come in and browse or to take advantage of our lending library. That's in 220 Strong Hall at the University of Kansas. Our guest tonight, as I mentioned before, Dr. Emily Taylor, Dean of Women at the University, Peggy Baldwin, who is the director of the Resident Theater at the Hashinger Center for Creative Arts, and Margie Swinth, an administrative intern at Menninger's. We believe that we have a very interesting topic for tonight's program. Our discussion will center around a new book that has just recently been released, and it's, the title of it is How to Go to Work When Your Husband is Against It, Your Children Aren't Old Enough, and There's Nothing You Can Do Anyhow, which I think is a very appropriate title. It's published by three women, Felice Schwartz, Margaret Shifter, and Susan Galati, who all work with a program called Catalyst. Emily, can you give us some explanation about what this organization is and what kinds of philosophy and programming they do?
Well, 10 years ago, in 1962, a group of college presidents of liberal arts colleges for women, including Wellesley and Smith and Sarah Lawrence, Lawrence College, and one other, got together to discuss the problems that they could see developing. I think it's very interesting timing because 1962 was after the appointment of the Presidential Commission on the Status of Women, but before they had a chance to give the report and before the publication of Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique. These two reports, American Women and Feminine Mystique, certainly would have to be considered the catalyst for the reopening of the of the women's movement, or for tremendous interest in the women's movement. These people were all concerned over the fact that they were educating a great many women, and at the same time, decreasing numbers of them were making any use of this education other than, of course, in their personal life and in their homes. That may have been all right with them during the 50s, because the women were satisfied, but they were getting increasing pressures from the women as to what's this all about. So they started the nonprofit organization, Catalyst, in order to try to work at, to have some pilot projects to see whether it was possible to get educated women and employers together so that these educations that they had provided could have better use.
Do you know of any of the actual programs and what kinds of help they provide to women that do use their facility?
Yes, they've offered a number of pilot programs, and everything which is in this book, which incidentally is a serious handbook, even though it's the title is very clever. I think the title is more of a come-on than anything else because it's an essential handbook. For women who are interested in getting back into the workforce and for employers who are being encouraged to look at the contribution that women can make in a little bit different way from what they have been. Always the assumption that only the full-time job, that they wanted to hire people only for full-time jobs, or for the most part, that's what's been done. So they've done a lot of encouraging of employers just to try something different, and encouragement of women to really evaluate themselves to what they want to do, and to take part-time jobs if that's what they're interested in. So they have done a great deal of listing of jobs. The book contains a Bidecker of where the jobs are, what's involved with various kinds of positions. what the kinds of financial awards are available in it. They've done a lot of self-guidance. They've done a great deal, I'm talking about Catalyst, of course, given a lot of individual help. They've published case studies of actual women and the activities they've gone through. They've published rosters of employers and registries of women who to facilitate this kind of partnership that they're trying to work out.
I would like maybe to talk a little bit about the kind of philosophy that's backing this kind of a program. I notice on their book jacket they state that the educated family women want to work where they are needed if offered responsible part-time jobs. Their life experience enables them to approach their work with maturity and judgment. Their productivity, working for shorter periods of time, is proportionately greater than the average full-time employee doing similar work. The fact that their pattern of living is by and large established reduces costly turnover. I think that's probably a radical change to what most employers and certainly personnel offices may believe. Maybe our guests could respond to that kind of philosophy and how maybe they've experienced this kind of job situation.
I would say from my own personal experience that has been true. First of all, I got married and had children and then returned to school. And at the time I returned to school, I was much surer of what I wanted to do in terms of a career to begin with. And I felt as if I was really preparing for something which I would grow into as I finished my degree, and I feel as if I'm much more stable in my decision than I might otherwise have been.
Peggy, how about you?
I guess that I find it rather strange that employers wouldn't consider this option very strongly. Part of it, the maturity factor, and part of it, the age and experience, but also I was under the impression that employers benefited greatly with part-time employment because even just financially, they don't have to pay vacation pay, they don't have to pay some of the fringe benefits, they don't have to pay retirement, and that usually a person who works part-time invests themselves, if it's a worthwhile job, on a full-time basis in terms of their energy and their involvement and their commitment. And so I think the employer is getting a good deal. I think he's getting a full-time commitment and quite often as many hours, even though it's rationalized that it's a half-time job. If you really have a dedicated and committed person, you're getting their full thrust, as it were, and you're only paying a half-time salary, and so I think it's really very much to the employer's benefit,
and certainly to a lot of women,
and to the women, right? Because I've always looked upon it as well, where the financial benefit maybe wasn't completely commensurate with the amount of energy and involvement. I felt like I was getting my freedom at the same time. In other words, I had the ability to work, but also my freedom, and I was willing to pay for that.
I certainly agree with you that from the point of view of the employer, it's a good thing. We will have, I'm sure, as we sort of review the ideas in the book, that we'll talk in more detail over some of those very points that you've made. But the truth about the matter is that, according to the reports of Catalyst, the most difficult thing has not been to the women themselves who want to return to work, but the employers who are set in a mold that makes it extremely difficult for them to see how they can take what they've listed as a full-time job and make it into two part-time jobs or even one part-time job, because Catalyst has some evidence that a woman working as many as 24 hours a week very often contributes as much, is as productive as one who works 40 hours a week. That may be because most jobs are not that fascinating, and that the energy level sort of wears out. And there are a lot of other factors, you know, coffee breaks, lunchtime, a lot of things that don't have to be considered at all. But it has been difficult, they report, to talk employers into doing this. As a matter of fact, one of the sort of objections that I have to one thing which is said in the book concerns personnel officers who are doing the hiring taking care of matters of that kind. I think that the authors give them unnecessary blame. Feel that they're the ones who are talking the employers out of it. My suspicion would be that it'd be the other way around, that these people work under definite constraints and restrictions as to what they can offer, and that if they have a full-time job to offer and suddenly two people showed up to take it, I think there'd be some real questions asked.
They probably have to try it first and then realize the benefits from it. It's getting them to try it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm.
There's an interesting foreword to the book that we're talking about. It's a memo, and it concerns Parkinson's Law, which is work expands to fill the time available for the completion of it. And he goes on to say in this foreword, "Let me ask you executives a question. Would you rather have a 40-year-old woman 4 hours a day or a 22-year-old woman 8 hours a day working at any particular non-secretarial job in your company? Well, baby, if you pick the 22-year-old, you've got the wrong glands in charge of your decision-making process. Consider three things. One, the turnover will probably be 40% versus 15%. Two, there are many jobs that human beings can't stand working at for 8 hours a day. And three, your 40-year-old woman will accomplish as much or more toward the real objective of the job in 4 hours as Miss Mooncalf will in 8.
That's probably not quite fair to all 22-year-olds.
No,
not all Miss Mooncalf.
I'd like to
object
at that point right now. But it's interesting.
We have to protect them, too.
I think that something that goes along with productivity on a part-time job is that someone who is working full-time looks to her job for more than just getting the job done. She has other needs to meet during those 8 hours that she or he is on the job. Whereas if you are working for part-time, you may picture your job as being an event where you mainly work and you meet your other needs outside of the mm-hmm. job situation.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I think that maybe leads us a little bit into the kind of historic women's economic role historically. Dean Taylor, I know that you've talked a great deal on this subject before. Maybe you could just kind of recap some of those ideas.
Yes, I think very briefly, because we have talked about this, of course, many times, but the Catalyst authors feel that we've sort of come full circle. I think everybody's either seen or seen the play, the movie, or read the book Gone with the Wind, and you'll recall that the mother in Gone with the Wind spent a great deal of time. Here she was, the wife of the plantation owner. She spent a great deal of time, you know, helping the sick and the poor, birthing babies and taking food to the hungry and all the rest of it. Plus the fact that she ran the household. She certainly was working. And we all know, of course, about the Kansas pioneers and all the rest of them. We hardly, if we even watched the late movies, couldn't miss the fact that everybody was working. In fact, I think two times, I don't know who's helping us out here, but two times in the past 2 weeks I have watched the late night show on the... Did you see the one with Robert Taylor and the Westward the Women?
Mm-mm.
Where he took a group of women to California, just 2,000 miles, started out with some men to assist, but something conveniently happened to all of them. And so the women themselves, starting out with 140 of them, took the wagon train across the country to California and succeeded in getting there without, according to the play, losing any of their femininity in the process. But certainly women did work. And until the Industrial Revolution came along and took the work out of the home, that's where they were. And then they followed the work if they had to, but we really aren't talking in this book about the kind of woman who had to go to work in order to keep soul and body together. In fact, there's an assumption made throughout the book that educated women can get an educated man to support them if that's what they choose to do, and that therefore this is a choice that they make. The actual statistics, of course, on unemployment indicate that a great many people, the vast majority of women, work because they need the money or want it. Not necessarily need it, but want the additional things and the additional education that for their children that a job will bring to them. But at least as we developed a very large mass middle class, it did make it possible for the first time in the history of the world, except for very, very few upper-class women or nobility to have a choice as to whether they worked or not. And we all know, you know, I mean, you could run through this entire century. We know that the middle class in large numbers was actually born at that time. We know that the First World War drew many women again into the labor force and out of a sense of patriotism. We know that the Depression drove additional women into the labor force, that the Second World War had the same patriotic effect, and then the post-war period and up until the 60s of the Great Return to the home. And it is about these women that the educators are expressing so much concern. Because they tried it, and it didn't work for the majority of them. It wasn't enough. But they were left, most of them, with a liberal arts education, with the ability to deal with ideas, with no specific skill, which they saw as saleable. And I think the beauty of this book is that it teaches women how to analyze what they really do have, even if they have never worked at all, and even if they have never learned any skill that anybody told them could be sold to anybody.
That's really valuable. Mm-hmm. I think the book terms that life experience.
Right. Uh-huh. Which happens, of course, to everyone, but the life experiences that a woman has had who has married and had a family, and who many of them will say they don't know how to do anything, it's amazing.
How much they can do,
as you analyze, just on the basis of the experience that they have had in operating a home and in rearing a family.
But that's a very internal process for the woman to analyze herself, to look within, to face herself, to decide that, to take stock of herself.
That's
and decide
right.
that this
mm-hmm.
is something that she wants to do and marshal her resources to enable herself to do.
So in so many cases, it was a sort of a trial and error. When the woman decided that she would go to work, she just took anything that was being offered. Barbara Walters of the Today Show, who read an advanced copy of this book, said that this is the most important, authoritative, and factual book. I wish it had existed when I first began to work. I don't know how she started out, but I do know, and I'm sure you folks do too, many women who have just sort of searched about without making any true analysis either of herself, her strengths and weaknesses, or without having any idea of what the job market really was or what kinds of services were needed.
Now, the book is not talking about women just going out and doing any kind of work. They're talking about meaning jobs that have some purpose and meaning to
That's
them.
That's right. It's brain work, which Peter Drucker tells us, he's quoted several times in the book, is always in short supply.
I can see then how the Catalyst is a valuable organization, because a woman may want to analyze her assets and not know what sort of framework to put them in, and it sounds as if the Catalyst can offer a framework with which mm-hmm. she can analyze herself.
They're hoping, too, that employers will read it, of course.
Yes.
Because it certainly would be a rare employer, it seems to me, who, after all, is in the business of making money, who would not be interested in the kinds of evidence, not just ideas, not just philosophy, but true evidence that these people have to offer as to what actually happens, which will bring money into his coffers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they make a very good analysis of improving that, too.
Mm-hmm.
The book kind of starts out with the first chapter called The Good Life, and it's more of a discussion. It's kind of the first step. It's that a woman may feel certain things but not be able to articulate what it is, what kind of frustrations and they are, and how she doesn't really feel this self-worth that she thinks she should from only a family or home situation. And the first chapter is then devoted to kind of bringing to light some of the advantages to having a career outside the home and with also a family. They devote a few paragraphs to just the aspect of identity, mm-hmm. that men receive much of their identity from what they do, from their work outside of the home, and how they make money, and you know how they make money for their families too, and that that's a vital part of any human being's identity is what they do. And since maybe housework and staying home has not had the kind of prestige that
say, going out and actually earning money in society in some kind of set-up situation, that a woman does lose some kind of self-identity. Can either of you respond?
I can identify with that. Oh, but you looked like you were going to say something, weren't you?
No, go ahead.
Yes, I had had a career before I was married. I was an actress and then married and went through a period of realizing, well, I had always couldn't combine a career and marriage, that it wasn't possible for me because I was highly ambitious and very concentrated, and I didn't know how I could split my concentration that way. So when I decided to get married, I gave up my career. That was one of the assumptions that I made. But after a period of about 5 years, I can look back now and see that I went into a state of deadness. I mean, I really think I got numb and dead inside. Even though I kept doing things, I kept directing theater and all, it was always as a, my husband being a minister, it was within the church, or it was volunteer, or it was for children, or something like this. It wasn't something where it was my focal point and my dedication and, you know, had my identity, had the value of a job, you know. I mean, I'm really not working for money, even though since I'm partially employed by Dean Taylor, I shouldn't say that in front of her. She'll cut my salary.
You don't have much anyways.
But I'm working because I want to work, and because a job in using the theater and my art and my creativity is the way I live best.
Margie, do.
I think I respond very similarly to what Peggy said. I found that my conception of being a housewife didn't allow for me to express my own individuality. Now, that had something to do with my conception of what it is to be in the home, but I found that for me, my identity, my sense of myself as an individual apart from the other members of my family has been enhanced by going out and having a job. And I think having an income that is all my own makes a difference, too.
Yes, that too, although I experienced this, I think not every woman, but maybe a lot of women have to go through the same process of this guilt feeling of, why isn't it enough for me? You know, other women are happy being mothers and staying in the home and raising their children, and this is very important, and society says it's important, and all, you know, and so why am I not satisfied, you know? And yet it finally became quite apparent that I wasn't.
And it doesn't mean that your husband isn't important or your children important or that you object to being Don's wife or
somebody's mother.
You know, Catalyst, the Catalyst book also refers to the reduction of guilt on the part of the husband whose wife is bored and frustrated, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting point. Because at the beginning of the title, you know, is How to Go to Work If Your Husband is Against It. Actually, there are very few examples of the husband being against it, except in one case of a Frenchman who felt that it wasn't appropriate. Sometimes there were mild objections, but for the most part, all the factual statistics too now indicate that it isn't husbands, not certainly not educated husbands, who are urging their wives to come home. They're rather urging them to demand their rights, the appropriate salary for the level of job that she has.
That's an interesting point, because when you told me about the title of the book, and I began to think about your husband being against it, I realized that I would think one of the prerequisites would have to be that your husband supported you and accepted it. I mean, I think you can go to work without that, but it makes it twice as hard, and it then puts a great deal of strain on the familial situation and the interpersonal relationship, and you could do it, but I think it would be so abrasive and so difficult, and you know, I have to say that I'm very grateful for the fact that Don has supported me, and grateful as soon as I say it, I think, I shouldn't say that, you know, why should I be grateful for something that's my own right, you know, and yet I realize how hard it could be, and how difficult a man could make it for you if he really was against it. And I think that there's a great deal of adjustment for the husband. Mm-hmm. It's a very, I think, even if intellectually he is for it completely, when faced with the actual facts of what this is going to mean to him, his involvement in the family, his acceptance of the responsibilities, more responsibility in the family, conflicts of schedules, and just a lot of details. When it comes down to the cold, hard facts, it gets hard. It gets difficult for the man, and then it becomes an adjustment for both of you and the entire family.
Of course, the other side of the coin is that if the woman doesn't go to work or doesn't do something to relieve the frustration or fulfill herself, it's going to be even worse.
That sounds like a threat.
But also, I think that we're talking about maybe a husband's role in this whole thing, and I think that probably many men would be more than willing to take on more responsibilities within the home because it can expand their role and get more into men's liberation or expanding roles and their being able to be closer to families and share in some, you know, family kinds of things that they weren't able to before.
One of the very interesting case studies that's described in here is a very efficient woman who had run her household very efficiently and done everything for the family and tried to continue doing those things, you know, after she took a job. Hers was really a full-time job that she took. And she was able to do these things, but the family was beginning to recognize not only that she was terribly overworked, but it almost seemed as if she didn't trust them to do anything. Mm. And when she finally went away on a trip for the company for which she was working, they took over and did a number of things, and when she came back, she found them so self-sufficient that then that worried her a little. And so she said, well, it looked as if they really didn't need her. So they explained to her that they certainly did need her. Her husband said, you really wouldn't expect me to get a great deal of pleasure out of cooking hamburgers in the fireplace every night. But after all, there are some things we can do. And her children, who seemed unusually intelligent, simply decided some things. That the young daughter was 14, said, from now on, we're going to cook the breakfast. It was one of the chores that that the mother had been taking care of. And they sort of divided things up, and the family became really a working unit where everybody was more satisfied.
That would certainly seem to foster more independence on the part of children, too, who need to learn skills and things and not be so dependent, you know, on one member of the family. I think we need to take a station break here for a few minutes, and then we'll be right back with the feminine perspective.
Munich, Germany, 1972, connotes an aura of sadness as one recalls the tragedy of the Israeli massacre at the Summer Olympics. As the Munich Philharmonic Orchestra played the funeral march from Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, millions felt the sorrow of the families of the slain athletes. Music has a way of expressing emotions more than words ever can. Whether it is sorrow or jubilance, music transcends all language barriers. During the month of January, KANU will present Orchestras of the World, a series of four stereo concerts presented by the Olympic Cultural Program in conjunction with the 1972 Olympic Games. During this series, you will have the privilege of hearing the great orchestras of Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union, among others. These orchestras will perform the music of emotion, an experience creating a catharsis of the joy and sorrow of the great composers with that of your own. Listen to the Orchestras of the World, Sunday afternoons at 3 on Stereo 92, KANU, Lawrence. KANU, Lawrence. Here again is Casey Ikey.
Welcome back to A Feminist Perspective. Tonight we are doing a kind of book review show, and we're discussing a recent book that's come out entitled How to Go to Work When Your Husband is Against It, Your Children Aren't Old Enough, and There's Nothing You Can Do Anyhow. Our guests are Dr. Emily Taylor, Peggy Baldwin, and Margie Swinth. We were in the process of discussing the kind of the pros, more of the pros than the cons, I think, in this case of a woman combining a family and career. I think we had just talked maybe about, or had we talked about children at all and their involvement and how this may foster independence on their part. And
yes.
Do either of you have children?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
We both do. For me, this has been very important because I've had to rely upon my 7-year-old boy, Mark, and my 8-year-old daughter, Kirsten, to carry on some of the jobs that I would ordinarily have tried to do. And I've discovered all sorts of potential in them that I wouldn't have otherwise known was there. So it's been, in a way, a gift to myself to learn a little bit about them. And they've been competent beyond my dreams at times.
That's nice.
My children are younger. My youngest, Joy, is 3 and Eve is 6. And so I think I encounter, and I'm sure Margie has too, the fact that child care is very important, good child care. I don't feel good about just leaving my children with anyone. I want to leave them with someone who enjoys children and they enjoy them, and that's very important. But also, now Don has absorbed a lot of the responsibility, and while I don't find that they are necessarily doing that much more because they're not at the age that they're able to do very much, I find that their reliance on their dad is much more. That when something goes wrong, the first cry is for mommy, but if that doesn't work, the next one is for daddy, whereas before it used to go on and on and on until mommy responded, you know. And also Don is feeling really good about his involvement with the girls, and I have found myself having to let go of some of this sense of responsibility that I had to do everything for my children. Mm-hmm. And when I have let go, it's been a really nice feeling to know that they weren't being cheated. That was another thing. I couldn't go to work and have my children come out on the short end. It had to be that somewhere along the line it would be compensated for. And I think we've worked it out so far so that when I'm not there, a good part of the time, Don is there, and they are developing really nice relationships that probably wouldn't have happened in that depth, maybe until much later or never.
Yeah. I would second that. And I think I have discovered, too, that actually some of these things that I thought was very important for me to do, not only can Bob do them, he can do them far better than I.
For instance?
Like teaching Kirsten how to multiply. Or, you know, just sitting down and spending time with her and some of these things that I find of only peripheral interest, he really enjoys and will pick up and follow through.
There's an excellent chapter 4, on realities, hard and soft, which really deals with three things, with time and with money and with what professionalism really means. But one of the ones on time deals with child care. Of course, it'd be true of money, too. It's rather interesting that no mention is made in this book of child care centers. But many, many practical bits of advice are given as to ways in which people can respond to the need for the kind of child care that your people are talking about.
Mm. So they talk at all about housekeepers?
They talk about housekeepers, and there were people who got them. They talk about grandmother types. We've seen a lot of this recently, a very interesting public television show on this on the subject of grandmothers who are taken each day to a center, a hospital for children who are crippled or who have problems of one kind or another, and the beautiful relationship that's growing up between these two people, both of whom with great needs, and of course, again, from a strictly practical point of view, this has taken a great many people, given them a new sense of worth, taken them off welfare rolls, given them somebody to love and somebody who loves them, and so it's a kind of a beautiful arrangement. They talk about mother's pools and about various kinds of camps and supervised tours, and they talk about the husbands.
And students also.
And students.
If you're at a university community.
Right. Mm-hmm. And vacationing high school and college students. The whole thing, as we've heard from so many people, the important thing, of course, is that both the father and the mother have the time to give really quality attention to their children, rather than just how much time is.
Right, and this is what I find, that I'm much more focused now, that because time is limited, the weekends, for instance, are set aside, and most of the time we try to make them inviolate, and we plan specific activities. And I find that time management is very, very important. I don't have as much social life, but then a lot of that is taken care of in terms of my work. But I have to find time for Don's and my relationship and spending time together there, and then definitely giving the children focused and concentrated attention so that I don't feel that they're getting slighted.
Let me interrupt briefly right here. We'd like to invite anyone in the audience to call in questions or comments. The phone number here is 864-4530, 864-4530.
When I mentioned housekeepers, I was thinking about the fact that I don't think it's possible, at least it isn't for me, to continue as the woman did in the example, to have a job and then continue to keep her household running immaculately and efficiently. I think it's very, very important, at least it has been for me, to have someone come in and clean once a week. I know that some people in the feminist movement feel that you shouldn't be hiring other women to do your dirty work, you know. And I really can understand that, but at the same time, I can't work unless I have this task taken care of, because I don't have the energy to do both, and I would rather pay someone else, and it doesn't have to be a woman, a salary, you know, of some sort to have this job done. But I can't keep, I'm just not Superwoman. I thought I was at one time, but I can't keep it all going, you know. So I think it's really important.
And that wouldn't bother me in the slightest, because I don't consider it my dirty work that I don't want to do. If I had time enough, I would enjoy keeping
my house. Well, I can't say I feel that. I won't go that far.
But I do think it's a question of allowing everybody to make a decent living. And for those who have made this their work, to deny it on the grounds that it's somebody else's dirty work. We could say that about all aspects of our work that were less interesting to us than something
right.
else. Because I also don't think that housework is entirely the work of the woman, obviously. It's the work of everybody who lives in the family to the extent that it's possible. Incidentally, you're talking about the age of your children. I'm kind of interested in camping. And one of the things I've noticed in every camping book is that they're pointing out how important it is that everybody have a job, no matter how simple it is. Even a three-year-old, there are things you can do.
Right.
May break a few dishes and get them taken from one room to the next, but it's probably worth it.
I just meant that could really take the burden off of me.
Yes.
You know?
An interesting anecdote I'd say about how culture has changed is that we were talking about a housekeeper at home, and my 8-year-old daughter asked me very seriously if I would consider having a male housekeeper if anyone applied.
Mm.
And she was very antagonistic that I should, eager that I should say yes, of course, which I was able to say.
8 years old.
Yes.
Well, they have, of course, the service organizations are becoming quite common. In one section of the book that deals with working for yourself, which is, of course, not an unmixed blessing. They talk about franchises and about small businesses and about service kinds of things that can be done. Certainly one of the coming ones that you find now in every city are, and I believe we have them right here in Lawrence, are commercial groups that come and do all these things in the home. So there's no longer a question of the generalist, but they're bringing in a number of specialists who sweep through the house, and in a very short time, the whole thing is clean again. Which, incidentally, is an idea for a woman who would be interested in that kind of thing to establish such a business.
That's interesting. Sounds like a good idea.
I'd just like to add a comment that, as Casey was commenting earlier, students are a very good source, or have been for me. I've advertised in the local paper for a housekeeper, and my 2 children are in school, and so I've found remarkably good help from KU with girls who come after school until I get home from work, and they take very good care of the children and the house for just a few hours a day.
It's helpful to them too financially.
Yes, and it's time they have to spare. It's not too much time for them.
So your part-time job is creating a part-time job for someone else.
I think one of the beauties of this book is that it really does get kind of down to earth and the real practical aspects of how to go about, you know, how to start thinking of yourself and how to how to really, start at the very base level. I think maybe you two would want to give your own experiences about this, but the time factor, they give, I think, a very good discussion about how you actually figure out how much time you need to do certain things and what kinds of things you can give up and how to go about finding that out. One thing that they mentioned that I can remember is that one suggestion is to keep a log, like for a week, keep a very accurate log of exactly what you do and how much time it takes, including things like how much time it takes you to find the ammonia bottle that your husband left in the garage and put it back where it's supposed to be. Very intricate and time-consuming, because everything is, and how much time it took to do the log.
Yes, but the advantage of the log is that most of us really can't say how we spent our time.
Yes.
And until we put it down, it's like looking at how you're spending your money.
Right.
You may just know that you don't have very much left, but and say such things as, I wonder what happened to it, or where did it all go, which we also say about time.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of time that it takes to do a log for a couple of weeks, I think, would be quite revealing.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that the advantage that the book points out is that then you can decide which ones of those things you'd be willing to give up. How many of the coffee clatches, how many conversations with neighbors, perhaps some of your reading, or whatever it is that you're putting your time in on, since you have been since we all use 24 hours a day. Obviously, if you're going to do something you haven't been doing before, you either have to do other things more efficiently, or you have to give up some of the things you've been doing before.
Mm-hmm.
But the authors claim that in the process of doing this, that many women in setting priorities for themselves have found out that they were putting in quite a bit of time at just doing some things they didn't want to do anyway.
Yes.
And that if, for example, you're doing your own laundry, and that isn't one of your great loves, just even sending your laundry out can make a great deal of difference in the amount of time that it takes and free you of something that you really didn't want to do anyway.
And then it makes it possible to even do that when you do have a job to compensate
for that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it does call your values into question then. And that again, is a
mm-hmm.
valuable process.
Mm-hmm. They really urge against any kind of wishful thinking. And just somehow it'll all work out.
Oh. Yes.
And without sitting down and figuring it out, without recognizing the point you made of how you're doing something different will affect your family, your husband, your children, your other relatives. Remember that a lot of people who do go to work are also taking care in one way or another of a relative other than those in the immediate nuclear family. The woman, for instance, who's been accustomed to stopping in every afternoon to shore up a friend or a relative who comes to depend upon this, that some accommodation has to be made. Of course, she may find out, the person who's been this dependent person may find out that she too's better off.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gives the woman who is engaging in this process a good practice for the future to make sure that she never becomes that dependent woman who's expecting somebody to call and give her emotional shoring up every day.
Or she may be hired to do that kind of reinforcing and counseling and human relations work that does need to be done, and she may be someone who can do it very well.
Mm-hmm.
Because of her experience.
Yes, yes.
Previous experience.
To get back to your point, though, for just a moment about a woman needing to be concerned about how she spends her time and needing to be somewhat organized as she goes into a job. I think, on the other hand, getting ready to take a job can sound more overwhelming than it is. I found that I panicked in how I was going to make all these preparations and get ready to leave the home. And I found that actually a morning, maybe two mornings, got much of the major preparation and decisions out of the way once I sat down and really worked at
mm-hmm.
it.
I think that's true, because when they talk about the analysis of the situation, I think they're not talking about taking 6 months in order to put off the decision-making process, but to sit down and do it.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think, too, that we should kid ourselves. I think I have found that now I live a very complicated life. I mean, it wasn't uncomplicated before,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of scheduling and time and energy and pacing myself, another thing is energy.
I'm not 22 anymore, and the maturity factor is there. And in one, on one side, it's a very strong point. On another side, I don't have as much energy as I had when I was 22, and consequently, I don't want my family to always get just the dregs of my energy. And so, and also, when I know I have a 10-month job or 12-month job, I know I've got that far to go, and it's a long race. So I've got to pace myself. Otherwise, I have been the kind of personality, and this comes in your assessment of yourself, that I'll blow everything. You know, I'll give the full energy value the first month or so, and then I don't have anything left. I can't make it. You know, and so it's been a very good process for me, learning to pace myself and to not waste energy. And this has been very important for me to learn.
I think you're right. I do think, though, that I wouldn't associate that with your advanced age.
Maybe I'm getting smarter, though.
I think energy levels differ greatly, you know, even at
yes.
12 or 16.
Oh, yes, I know that.
The man who is the director, who is the director of this project I was mentioning, of the grandmothers and the handicapped children, was 81. I think that's just delightful, because yes. One of the things that so many women who are going back to school for additional training, which may be, of course, one of the things that the woman decides. We have 8 million women in the United States today who have had a partial college education. We also have the dreadful statistics from the past, which have improved somewhat, but not greatly, of many women. A very high percentage of the best qualified high school women who don't go on for any further college training at all. And it's about these women that this book is talking to. Not that they have to be a college graduate, but rather they're talking about brain work. And the one of the fears that women so often have is that all their skills are so rusty, and how in the world are they going to compete in the classroom and all the rest. And the kind of information that's been given us through the psychology of learning has led us to believe, I think, sometimes that the level of ability to learn goes down rather sharply with advancing age. And aside from senility, you know, this is really nonsensical.
No, I don't.
If Oliver Wendell Holmes, Justice Holmes, could learn a new language at 92, and if John Dewey could become a father at that time, and I don't mean just physically, but could rear a child, I think that there's no great evidence that this is so very, very gradual that it needn't bother anyone.
Yes, and I wasn't really talking about lacking the energy to do the job, but really my own knowledge of myself, which is that I waste energy, you know, mm-hmm. and...
Which you probably would do anyway, even if you were just in a home situation, the expenditure of energy.
Yeah, well, and that led me to the point of how women, the boredom and the frustration sometimes of the home life creates a great energy loss and problems and all, because there is no focus, there's no way to keep all that energy, that ability, that talent gets all bottled up, and there's no place for it to go. And if it has a focus, then it seems to me, at least it feels within me, that there's a flow, and that's much healthier.
You know, all this, though this has been mentioned several times by one or another of us, I think it's worth saying again that, or talking a little bit about why is it that so many people, so many women, find it so difficult to face up to frustrations and boredom. Who feel that this is somehow wrong for them to be bored or frustrated, and who therefore become the apologists for the educated housewife who does not make any use of her talents outside of the home. Haven't you run across that, of people saying, you know, what is wrong with the woman who wants to, who doesn't find her husband and children a sufficient life for herself?
You hear it frequently, you know. I think it's a matter of conditioning and propaganda that we've.
That's more been what you articulated earlier. That's the kind of feelings that you had. You know, your first twinge of guilt was questioning. Mm-hmm. You know, why do I feel this way?
Yes.
And it's because you know you've heard other people say that, and you had that kind of thing put on you.
Yes, and I'm not even sure where I absorbed it from, mm-hmm. you know, but I think I have carry part of that guilt because of the fact that I really, a career is very important to me, and it also is very important that my family is happy, and so it's, I have to balance both of those.
I was on a panel once a couple of years ago where a young woman who was doing great many things with her life and who had two children, who, according to my observation, were doing very well, who was accosted after the programming publicly by a woman in the audience who simply told her she was a bad mother. For no better reason, she didn't know her, she didn't know her children, so for no better reason than that she had expressed her lack of complete fulfillment with just the child rearing and family situation. And I would maintain that the woman who makes such an attack has not analyzed herself or analyzed anybody else for that matter, or the situation has not yet been able to bring herself to see that these things should be matters of choice. And that if to her this is a totally satisfying life, as of course it is to many people during certain periods of their life, but we were sold in the 50s a notion that somehow or other, which simply didn't give any cognizance to the fact that children do grow up. And that one cannot, no matter how much you may want to, for the entire span of a very long lifetime that the average American woman has, play this mothering role.
We don't have too much time left. I wanted to discuss very briefly the one of the last chapters talked about three different kinds of jobs that take into consideration a part-time worker, and that was the paired job, the split-level job, and the split-location job. Dean Taylor, could you maybe analyze or explain those, mm-hmm. what those three terms mean?
Well, the paired job, it's the one that probably the first experiments were made with teachers. Because there you had two people with comparable background and training who simply agreed to share a job. And the school board and the school authorities agreed to let them do it. It was the most obvious of all things. For instance, even in the elementary teacher who has, every elementary teacher does not have the same set of skills. One of them may be much better at teaching mathematics, for instance, another one better at teaching linguistic skills. The children in a classroom, of course, could profit from the relationship with two different personalities. And one of them simply came in the morning and one came in the afternoon. The school board saved money. They were paying each one of them half salary, and I think it's rather unfortunate, although it is true that there are some real financial advantages. There's one disadvantage, and that's in Social Security, because there, of course, since you pay on a maximum of 10-8, if your $12,000 job divided into two $6,000 jobs would require a greater expenditure for Social Security. But in all other ways, an insurance program, every other kind of fringe benefit that you can think of, everybody profited from that kind of a paired arrangement. But it does require equal skills.
It would probably completely do away with the idea of substitute teachers and having to...
That's right. They can fill in for one another. If somebody's sick, the other one helps her out. And then when it's the contrary situation. Also, when they... if there's a family problem or a child of one of them is ill, it makes it possible for them to do away with the concept completely of the substitute teacher. The split-level job means a job that's been set up that requires two different levels of ability. And there, it's also pretty obvious that if one level of ability that's required is rather high, and then that doesn't take all the time, however, but there's other kind of work that needs to be done, the same woman is doing it, feeling put upon when she's doing work beneath her level of ability. And if it's the other way around, of course, the lower level of ability, then they can't do the higher level job. And the split location job, the Condé Nast publications were the first to experiment with this, and they've done a beautiful job. It means that if it's a job that can be, if it's intellectual piecework, like writing, part of it can be done at the office and part of it can be done at home, or the librarian's work, where part of it would be in public relations and dealing with the public, part of it is in ordering books and knowing what new things are on the market, where she doesn't have to be in exactly the same location to do it. Mm-hmm. These are some of the kinds of things with which Catalyst is experimenting.
I think one last idea that I would like to just put in very quickly is the idea that these kinds of jobs will, I believe, open up many doors to a pair job or a split level or split location job between a husband and a wife.
That's the point I
wanted
to make.
Wish we had more time to talk about that and its implications. Right.
But I think we should also have a program on one of the chapters, which we haven't touched on at all, what they call professionals without pay. If in the lineup of the hierarchy of values, the money is not important at all, either in terms of one's self-respect or what have you, and after all, money has been very much tied up with the idea of professionalism, that there is a place for this kind of a volunteer, but it is very, very different from what we usually think of in terms of the volunteer.
Mm. We're running out of time now. I'd like to thank those of you who tuned in tonight and thank our guests for coming. Next week's program will be called Black Women and the Women's Movement. Thank you again for tuning in to A Feminist Perspective.
Listen again next Monday at 7 for A Feminist Perspective, presented in cooperation with the Office of the Dean of Women at the University of Kansas.